Hello, and welcome to the TAA teleconference, Writing and Editing Effectively, Using Fast Writing and Slow Editing, presented by Dr. Sonia Foss, Professor of Communication at the University of Colorado, and Dr. William Waters, an Assistant Professor of English at the University of Houston Downtown. Sonia's research and teaching interests are in contemporary rhetorical theory and criticism, feminist perspectives on communication, the incorporation of marginalized voices into rhetorical theory and practice, and visual rhetoric. She is the author or co-author of the books Destination Dissertation, A Traveler's Guide to a Done Dissertation, Rhetorical Criticism, Contemporary Perspectives on Rhetoric, Inviting Transformation, Feminist Rhetorical Theories, and Women Speak. Her essays and communication journals have dealt with topics such as invitational rhetoric, agency in the film Run, Lola, Run, feminine spectatorship in Garrison Keillor's monologues, visual argumentation, and body art. Dr. Foss earned her PhD in communication studies from Northwestern University and previously taught at Ohio State University, the University of Oregon, the University of Denver, Virginia Tech, and Norfolk State University. William's research and teaching interests are in writing theory and practice, the history of the English language, linguistics, and modern grammar. He is the co-author of Destination Dissertation, A Traveler's Guide to a Done Dissertation, and was the managing editor of La Puerta, A Doorway into the Academy. He also has published several poems in national journals. Dr. Waters earned his PhD in language and linguistics from the University of New Mexico and previously taught at the University of Maine, University College in Galway, Ireland, and Chungbuk National University in Korea. Sonia and William present the TAA-sponsored workshop, Destination Dissertation, Practical Strategies for Writing the Thesis and Dissertation, and Sharing Results, Crafting an Article. They also offer individual coaching. I will email all participants Sonia and William's contact information following the teleconference. It will also be posted with the recording. I now turn the teleconference over to Sonia and William.
Thank you.
Hello, everyone.
Hello.
This is Gail. I couldn't mute myself.
Okay, it should be all right, I would think.
It's okay. As long as you don't think you're going to have a lot of background noise, don't worry about it.
Okay.
So thank you all for joining us today, and, of course, thanks to TAA for sponsoring this workshop, and, of course, to Kim for setting everything up and handling all of these logistics. I'd like to let you know a couple of format things before we begin. First, you will see that you have an outline of the major ideas that we're going to cover today in handout number one, and so you might want to pay attention to that as we go through the workshop because it will help you keep track of where we are. And second, we'll stop almost halfway through to take questions on what we've covered so far, and then we'll have time at the end for questions again. So just please jot down your questions as they occur to you, and you'll have the chance to ask them at 2 points during the workshop. Okay, so let's get started. We don't intend to teach you how to write in this teleconference. What we want to do is to help you make the processes of writing and revising easier and more effective if they're difficult for you. So our focus is going to be on those places where scholars tend to get stuck or slowed down when they're writing. So our assumption in this teleconference is that you are clear about what you want to say, you know the ideas that you want to communicate, and now you want to put those ideas into print. You want to turn them into prose as quickly as possible and then polish that prose into a well-written dissertation, article, or book.
In order to do this, there's two key processes that we want to focus on. The first one is writing fast, and the second one is slow revising. We begin by separating these two processes because many people think that they're actually the same thing. And although some writers try to go faster by combining the two steps, it's actually much more efficient to keep them apart from each other, basically because they rely on different parts of the brain. Writing is capturing your ideas on paper, and revising is going to be sculpting your ideas more effectively, maybe even more eloquently. So in short, writing is about adding materials. Revising is about scrutinizing those materials, moving them, removing them, and transforming them.
So let's talk first about that first process, which is fast writing. When it's time for you to write, we want you to only write. Don't do any revising as you write. So what this means is that you will be writing a spew draft. And that is a draft where you write as fast as you can until you have a complete rough draft of a chapter or an article. So write without any concern for full sentences or proper spelling or correct grammar. Don't stop to correct typos or add citations. Don't stop to figure out the nuances of an argument you're making. Don't stop to reread what you wrote. Just keep going, typing as fast as you can. And we're talking about writing so fast that you're producing as many as 6 or 7 pages an hour. The pages should literally be flying out from your printer. So you're getting your ideas on paper in any form.
Flying out from the printer and flying around the room, maybe. we're committed to fast writing as one of the major ways to become a productive writer for a number of different reasons. The first reason that we're committed to it is that when you try to write perfect first drafts, it's actually not a very efficient use of time. You can lose a lot of the time that you invest in those drafts when you go back to reread them. Slow writing is an opportunity to make decisions that you might not end up keeping. Think about it. You might spend hours writing a perfect piece of text and then later find out that it doesn't fit into what you're saying. You might end up having to cut paragraph sections or even a whole chapter because it doesn't make sense anymore. The reason this is a problem is that when you cut those sections, you lose that time forever. If you went very, very quickly, produced those sections roughly, and then ended up cutting them, you don't lose as much time. I'm also guessing that the writing process for many people is difficult and full of pain. One way to let go of that and to make it fun again is to try to write as fast as you can.
A second reason that why we encourage you to do fast writing is that it's a method that works for big projects like a dissertation or a book. Sure, the perfect first draft method might work fine if you're trying to write a 20-page paper or a 20-page article. You can keep all of your ideas in your head for 20 pages worth. But a dissertation or any kind of longer writing project, though, is something entirely different. You can't possibly work out and keep in your head what you want to say for 100 or 200 pages. So that perfect first draft method will fail you if you try to write that many pages as a perfect first draft.
A third reason that we are really big fans of fast writing is that very often people are trying to make decisions about what to keep and what not to keep, how to emphasize a particular point really early in the process when they don't have enough information to make that decision. In fact, you can't make those decisions until you see the whole argument that you're going to set out. And so this is also one of the reasons that we think people agonize over which word to use and how to sculpt a particular sentence. They're trying to make decisions that there's no information to use.
We like to think of editing as you write, like moving into a new house or an apartment and trying to arrange the furniture by focusing on just one or two pieces. So it's kind of like moving a single table and a lamp here and there, until you get in just the right place. But the problem is, of course, that you've ignored the sofa and the chairs and the coffee table, and they might need to go in that exact place where you've positioned that table and the lamp. So the perfect place is no longer so perfect when those other pieces of furniture fill the room, and you probably won't be able to keep the perfect placement of the table and the lamp. So imagine instead placing all of the furniture in this rough, workable arrangement and then making smaller and smaller adjustments until the room is perfect. When you work from that rough arrangement, all of your adjustments take into account the whole, and there aren't any major surprises or changes along the way. So fast writing, then, gives you the arrangement of the whole room before you begin to make smaller adjustments.
Also, we think that fast writing is a good solution to making stronger drafts. When people try to write perfect first drafts, the perfect text, they very often make a weaker argument for two reasons. First, the first reason is that many people spend a lot of time going over and over and over the first few pages. If you're writing an article that's 20 pages long, you might spend a lot of time on the first 10 pages and then get tired and run out of time for the last 10 pages, so the article is unequal. Another reason that perfect first drafts can make a weaker overall text is that if you spend a lot of time investing into writing a section, and then you decide it's not really the best argument that you can make, you're going to resist cutting that section and throwing that away. Imagine that you have 5 perfect pages of prose, complete with exceptional wording, nice, exquisite examples, and carefully documented citations. Then imagine that you discover you no longer really believe what you worked on in those pages. You're going to be really reticent to let it go. And so then you're going to try to hold on to that, and even though it's irrelevant to your topic.
Yes, yeah, so once you spend all that time to create that perfect piece of text, you're not going to want to delete it. You're going to try to spend a lot of time trying to patch it up, trying to make it fit. And so then you limp forward, dragging with you something you know doesn't work, but you just can't bear to cut it. So in fast writing, in contrast, you work out the argument first, and then you might find yourself moving back and forth across several points, figuring out the key idea that's going to create your argument. But you do this before any of the polishing of your prose takes place.
If fast writing isn't something you've tried before, we really do encourage you to give it a try. But you might be saying to yourself, well, how do I go about doing this? There's a number of different strategies that will help you do fast writing. One of the most dramatic, and one that Sonia really, really likes doing, is having people turn off the computer screen. You can either, if you have a contrast, you can turn the contrast so the screen goes blank, or if you have a wireless keyboard, you can just take the wireless keyboard and turn the screen so you're not looking at it. The idea here is that what you really want to do is make it so that you can't reread the sentences that you just wrote. You can't go back and fix any typos or change any words. And in this way, there's nothing to do but to just keep writing.
Here's another strategy that might help you do fast writing if it's something that you've not done before. Let's say you're writing along and you can't think of the word that you want to use. Or maybe you know you need an example of something, but you can't think of one. Or maybe you need a citation, but you don't have the source right there. Well, most writers, when they find themselves in one of these situations, they stop and go find what they need. And that, of course, stops the fast writing, because once you leave your computer to take care of those things, it's so much harder to get writing again.
So we're suggesting that whenever you hit one of these places where you think you need to add some text, just resist that temptation to wander off. Instead, you're just going to type a note to yourself in the text about what to insert and where to do it. If you look at handout number 2 at the moment, you'll see this is an early draft. Actually, all of the drafts, all of the handouts, handout number 2, handout number 3, and handout number 4 are different versions of fast writing with various editing. Handout number 2 has no editing. And if you look at the third line down in this system, communication, use rhetoric instead with a question mark is ethical. You'll see that when Sonia was writing this, the note to herself to use rhetoric instead, she just puts in all capital and puts a question mark there.
Excuse
if you look
me?
Down a few lines, yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I don't have what you're speaking of as far as the examples. I just have the first 2 pages regarding your outline.
Okay, there were 4. There should be 4 handouts altogether.
Okay, that didn't come
hey,
with.
Who is this that's saying that?
This is Judy Cavey.
Judy Cavey. Okay, I will resend that to you. Anyone else?
Thank you.
Okay, great. You can imagine in your head. The idea is that we're just trying to show you that these drafts are written very quickly. If you look at anywhere on this draft, you'll see that on line 5, instead of further on the right-hand side, further he-ight say instead of might say, the next line down, that this symbol using capacity is inherent by rhetoric, whatever that means, right? The next line down, you see So see Johansson 3235 for more. So what's going on here is that there's no effort to change any of this stuff until you come back and you decide that you're keeping all of this. That way you won't lose time. So you're going to write, you're going to type in text or all capital letters, bold text, different colored font, whatever. Things like need example or supply citation, or you're going to type a question to yourself that when you come back to edit, you'll go ahead and respond to that. There's a couple of real big advantages to this. First, it keeps you writing fast, which gets everything out of your head and onto the page so that you can come back later and make decisions about it. More importantly, it sets up an artifact that when you come back and you have 10 minutes of time, 10 or 15 minutes of time, these small amounts of time now are useful. If you need a citation or if you're going to fix a spelling error or something like that, you can do that very efficiently in 10 or 15 minutes of time after you get your argument down. And if you're looking for several different pieces from the same book or the same article, then having them all written out, you just go and say, okay, I'm going to go to the library, check this article out, and now I'm going to fill in all the pieces that I remember reading.
Excuse me, I have one question for you.
Yes.
With that idea, would you also use what you spoke of earlier as far as you focusing on one thing? So if you had to go in and say you only had the 10 minutes, would you go in and just do maybe pick four or five things that you needed to insert as far as your notes and spend time focusing on that, or how would you actually come back and adjust those notes that you left for yourself?
A little bit, we're going to talk about that as you go along, part of the slow revising part.
Okay.
But generally we'd move from higher order concerns to lower order concerns.
Okay.
Just to clarify, it makes no sense to fix a spelling error if you're going to end up cutting a paragraph.
Okay.
For people, we'll talk about this in a minute, but for people who want to look at handout number 3, you'll see on the very top of handout number 3, half the page has been cut. If you spend a lot of time fixing that page and then you end up cutting it, you've lost that time forever.
Thank you.
Sure, yes.
I also want to say something about this handout number 2. This is actually a page I wrote. This was the very first draft, a fast writing draft for me. And if you look at it, you'll think, my goodness, how is this person ever going to turn this into something publishable? But in fact, I can do it, and I did do it. So you might think, oh my goodness, this is just a total mess. But we will be giving you ideas about how to take something this rough and turn it into something that's really good. Okay, so let's go back to some other ideas for strategies to keep yourself doing fast writing. And headings are another way to keep yourself writing fast. Headings are single words, short phrases, or complete sentences that cover all of the material under them until the next heading. So you're used to using headings to divide ideas in a paper or a chapter as guideposts to help your readers understand your content more easily. But you can use them in another way, too, that helps you keep writing fast.
You can use them to figure out how much each section of your chapter or article is going to take. You start by identifying how many sections will be in that chapter article. Then you give each of those sections a title, a name. Descriptive headings that explain a little bit more about the sections will make it easier for you to write fast because they clearly indicate what you're going to put in those sections, what the function of the section is. They may be headings like adolescent discipline problems in special education or common techniques for disciplining emotionally challenged students. Both of these are from our book, examples that we've used there. Any heading will do as long as you know what it means and what kind of content it tells you is going to go into that section.
So type all of your headings into your document when you first sit down to work on an article or a chapter so you can see in front of you all of the sections that you have to fill. And what you're doing here is turning a seemingly overwhelming project into many small steps. And when the size of what you have to write is small enough, then you can deal with it more effectively emotionally. So telling yourself, I only have to fill this small section, weighs very differently on you from, I have to write a chapter now. So when you're fast writing to fill in a section, you see a very doable, concrete task ahead of you that will maybe take 20 minutes.
After you've set up all of your sections with their titles, with the headings, you can tell how long each section will be, so you'll know how much you have to write for each section. For example, imagine that you're going to write a 30-page findings chapter or a 30-page article, and that when you look at your argument, you say, oh, well, I have five equal sections in this 30-page chapter or 30-page article. Well, now you know that each of those sections needs to be about 6 pages long. You've gone from doing a 30-page article to now only doing 5 6-page sections. Once you know that you have 6 pages to use for explaining your idea, you can look at that idea to see what smaller parts are included there. So you might look at the 6-page section and say, oh, this 6-page section actually is built around 3 other ideas. Then you know each of those 3 ideas is going to be about a page and a half to 2 pages. So now that you know how long each section is going to be, you can effectively limit the amount of information that you have to write to fill in that section. You're not writing everything you know about something. You're writing 2 pages about this argument in order to move it from one point to another point. This helps you pace out the project, and it tells you how in-depth you can go on a particular point as you're doing your fast writing.
Something else that might encourage you to keep writing fast is that you can jump around. In contrast to the method of writing a perfect first draft, where you typically have to start at the beginning and you develop the essay chronologically because you develop each idea from that previous one, with fast writing, you don't have to go in any particular order. Because you know the sections you want to write and you know what you want to say in each section, you can start writing in any section. So if you feel like starting with the justification of your data, start there. If you're in the mood to explain your research question, you can start with that section. When you can write on whatever section appeals to you at the moment, again, writing becomes much more fun. And if you do get stuck in a section, you can leave it for a while and come back to it later.
So even though you've figured out the content of your chapters and sections, it's likely that you'll still get stuck sometimes. That's not a problem. What we're suggesting is that you have a plan for getting out of being stuck. For example, while you're writing, you might not have a clear idea of what you should say about something. And so right now we're going to switch and talk about a few strategies that will help you get unstuck from having these blocks during fast writing.
So free writing is one of these strategies. And sometimes free writing about the ideas in the section where you're stuck will give you the energy and clarity that you need to find your way again. So free writing, as opposed to fast writing, is short, nonstop, timed writing that's designed to generate ideas, but it's not anything that you're going to keep in your actual draft. To use free writing to encourage your ideas to flow, try asking yourself some questions about the section that you think are important for you to answer. And so we're thinking here of questions like, well, who am I talking to? What am I trying to tell them? Why is this important? So just try writing really fast the answers to these questions. Or you might try free writing to answer questions like, why am I stuck? What's keeping me from figuring out this idea? So by writing for 5 minutes about one of these questions, for example, you'll often find your way back into the actual ideas of your paper or your chapter.
A second strategy to keep yourself going is to make a list of all the points that you think need to be in a section. So if you figured out you have this 2-page section and you're making a particular argument, if you can figure out all the points that are going to go in there, perhaps as a bulleted list, you can then go and organize them so that you know the order in which you want to write about those points, and then you simply go about fleshing out those points to turn them into sentences and paragraphs using fast writing.
Here's something else that you might try if you're temporarily at a loss for ideas while you're doing your fast writing. Talk through your ideas out loud, and this could be to a friend, to a nearby stuffed animal, or to yourself. If you're a teacher, you might imagine that you're in front of a classroom. and a student has just asked you to explain the idea on which you're stuck. You wouldn't just stand there and not respond. You would open your mouth and something would come out. So open your mouth and see what comes out and write that down. You're likely to discover that you know more about what you want to say than you thought you did. And you might even try this with a tape recorder so that you can capture your points easily when you're ready to write. Okay, so we've now covered the topic of fast writing. And so let's pause here and see if there are any questions so far.
Also, remember to, if you're going to ask questions, you have to push the four start on mute.
I have a question. My name is Joyce. When I'm writing, or maybe even fast writing, and go back on a second day to revise or edit, I find myself going back to the beginning of the draft, and sometimes that slows me down. I'm wondering, is that the right route, or should I just start where I left off?
You should start where you left off.
Yeah, start where you left off.
Okay, thank you.
You really want to complete the fast writing process before you do any revising.
Very good, thanks.
My question, Cyrus Williams, my question is, do you suggest we do as much as we can in one setting, and how much prep time should we do? Because I can see myself prepping for 2-3 days and, you know, going a little bit overboard in the prep. So how much is the balance between prep time and just sitting down and getting it out, and how much should we do and all that?
So what is involved for you in prep time?
Well, you know, an outline, probably I'm going to read a little bit to see what else, what other articles are out there. So I don't think that's really fast writing if I'm doing all that. So I get caught up in that stuff of getting a perfect outline.
We're talking about the exact opposite of that.
Yeah.
So you would start writing from what's in your head first.
Right.
You would start to. So let's say that whatever your project is, you're thinking that you're going to examine something, make a claim about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
You would exhaust what you can talk about, and that's what's going on in those rough drafts that we gave you examples of. You'll talk through whatever you know off the top of your head.
Mm-hmm.
You might say, check to see if someone else has done something about this, or check this.
Okay.
We recommend 3 to 5 writing periods a week, 3 to 5 writing periods a week of about 1 hour each time. When you're not in your writing period, then you can do that checking and you can do the reading and you can do that other stuff. But keep writing in your regular periods to keep moving forward.
Thank you.
And also, let me just add on to that.
We're
really committed to having your insights be featured in something you write. And so that's why we encourage you to do fast writing, even before you've done much preparation, just to see, well, what is it that I think and what is it that I know here? But there are also other kinds of writing. For some kinds of writing that I do a lot of prep. I mean, I'm working on a project right now where I've had to compile a whole bunch of information about what other people are saying, and then I'm going to do something different with that, but I need to know that. And so my prep time has taken a lot of lit review and coding of literature and sorting it, and so that's all gone on. But then when I sit down to actually write, I'm still doing this really, really fast writing, but I've got a lot more than just me now that I'm bringing in to that.
And just so you know, we do talk in great detail in Destination Dissertation about that literature review process and coding literature, which is much more efficient way to do literature and collect that background information.
Thanks.
Okay.
Any other questions?
I'm going to go ahead and start moving on to slow revising then, and if there's more questions about the first part, we'll stop at the end and take more questions there as well. So remember, we've split the fast writing and slow revising into two different processes. The fast writing is trying to get everything possible on the page, and then the second part of the process is to sculpt that. When you return, the first part of the process is getting your ideas down again. writing fast gets a complete first draft done in as short amount of time as possible. The shortness of the time is what's important because that keeps you from wasting time if you've ended up cutting or letting something go. You know what your entire draft says before you begin any of your revising. You have at least a big picture of your argument. Only after you have a completed spew draft as a result of this fast writing should you begin the revision process. Revision is a slower, more systematic process than the writing, and it's broken down into two parts just like the whole process. We break revision into editing and proofreading as two different processes. Again, many people actually consider editing and proofreading the same thing, but they're really two very different stages because they have two different functions. The decisions that you make when you're editing are going to be decisions about fixing and strengthening the argument. The decisions that you're going to be making about proofreading are going to be decisions about grammar, punctuation, and style. If you try to combine the two tasks together, the fields of focus are completely different. The field of focus for editing is very large, and the field of focus for proofreading is very small on the word or sentence level. If you try to combine the two tasks, it'll be like looking at both forest and trees at the same time. So begin with the editing and then move on to the proofreading when you've finished with your editing.
So editing involves higher level concerns and larger changes than proofreading does. When you're editing, you want to see things like, are your ideas in the correct order? Does your evidence back up your argument? Do you have effective transitions between paragraphs? Are you stylistically consistent?
So what we suggest is that you don't try to edit for everything at once. You'll see that some people do that, right? One of the women that asked the question said, when I start to write, I go back to the draft again. So you're editing and writing and revising all at the same time. What we suggest is that you try to go through your work serially. You make a number of passes through your chapter or your article, and each time you make a pass through, you edit for just one thing at a time. The reason for doing this is that you'll know, you'll have a good comfort level for, oh, okay, now I've done all the cutting that I'm going to do. Let me go back and start to edit. So let's look at the handout number three, if you can, handout number three that we've sent. Again, I want to emphasize, notice how rough this rough draft is. There's going to be a lot of changes to this. When we suggest editing, we think that you write very fast, you write one fast draft, but you might edit it 30 or 40 times. For some people, that sounds very scary, but we think that you're going very, very fast through each of those. If you look at number three, you'll see that the first pass through is to cut things. There's just a big X on the top. So you make a pass through and you remove any unnecessary information or text where you get off track. You make sure that you're only including information that's pertinent to making the argument, and then you ask yourself when editing to remove extra information if you really need the section or the sentence to make your argument. If you don't need it, you cut it.
So you'll notice there that I first started doing more detailed editing of that section, and then I decided, oh, this doesn't need to be in here, and then I just cut the whole thing.
Exactly.
So that's the first time of going through to see what needs to be removed. Then you want to edit a second time to rearrange the essential pieces of the remaining information so that you've got the clearest presentation of your argument. So here you're asking yourself if the major ideas included in your article or your chapter follow one from the other. So because you've already removed any extra information, things you know doesn't belong there, now you might need to rearrange some of the ideas to get the most out of your argument. So rearranging is what you're doing that second time you edit.
And, of course, it makes more sense to rearrange when you know you're only using you're only using pieces that you're going to keep. Once you've rearranged those pieces, you'll now be able to determine whether there's any gaps in your argument. So you're going to make a third pass through your article or chapter to fill in any gaps that are there. You're beginning to pay attention to anything that's missing examples or undeveloped arguments. So wherever you said, wherever you typed in, go find an example or put example here, give example here, this is where you start to fill those in. One way to do this is to check the thesis sentence. One way to check to see if you have any gaps is to check the thesis sentence of all your paragraphs to see if they connect to make one full argument. In order to do this, one of the things that we recommend is that you just type out the thesis sentence of every single paragraph. Just type them out into a list and read that list from top to bottom. If the list reads as complete, if it makes sense, then you know you don't have any gaps. If when reading through that list, you see, oh, okay, well, this point doesn't go to this point very well, you're going to need to fill in something.
So now you're on your fourth time through your draft, and your focus is now on your paragraphs themselves. So read each paragraph to see if what is in that paragraph fits with the thesis sentence of that paragraph. And make sure here that you assess the content against what the thesis sentence actually says, not what you intended it to say. Also ask yourself, do all of the ideas in the paragraph develop that thesis sentence? Are they all related enough to be in that same paragraph? And you might discover that you've got more than one idea in a paragraph and that it needs to be made into two paragraphs.
Let me just highlight one more thing about the handouts that we gave you before I keep going on. You'll notice that we're talking about making serial passes through these, doing one thing at a time. And if you look at these, you might say, well, it looks like a couple of things are going on at the same time. What we would say is that you can make, you print out a copy of your draft. You can go through and make cuts. And then after you make those cuts, you can go through and make changes on what's left there. We'll reprint the piece when it gets too noisy to actually follow what you're doing. So then you would just go and retype things and then print it out and start over again. So you can make many passes through on the same piece of paper, doing each of these things one at a time. Also, let me just highlight that in the overview that we gave you, we've written down each of these passes under move from larger concerns to smaller concerns. So I'm going to talk about the fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth passes here. You're going to go through a fifth time looking for transitions between paragraphs. So you're just going to check to see if you have words, phrases, or sentences that are making the connections between your ideas very clear. Usually because transitions summarize or restate the point you just discussed, and they're going to help let your reader know where they need to be, how they're moving along in the argument. So you might have to make those clearer. So decide if you need to make a transition more explicit or to rearrange the order of the paragraph to make a transition possible, and then create new transitions wherever they're missing or weak. You're going to do that for your fifth pass. You're going to then go through a sixth time moving down a level from the paragraphs down to sentences. You want to make sure, do you have complete sentences? Do you have a variety in the sentence types? And are the sentences themselves within the paragraph in the best order? Once you've finished with sentences, you're going to go through another pass, a seventh time, going through looking for word choices. So you'll notice we're going from larger order concerns to lower order concerns, mostly because if we cut a sentence, then we don't have to worry about words. Once we've gone through, we've made sure we're definitely using this chapter, definitely using this section, definitely using this paragraph, we're definitely using this sentence, that's when we want to make sure that we're making good word choices. So you go through and you make sure that you've chosen the best word, the most appropriate word to capture the idea you want to express. Finally, you're going to go through an eighth time, and you're going to start to review your spelling and punctuation to make sure that that's correct.
So after you've completed all of the steps of the editing process, going through multiple times for different things, then it's time to turn to proofreading. And proofreading is concerned with lower order concerns, like mechanical errors and formatting requirements. And you only begin proofreading after you're convinced that your draft is conceptually complete and stylistically sound. So this is the final step in polishing a chapter or an article. And it's crucial for a professional presentation of your ideas. You finish proofreading when you're absolutely convinced that there are no errors in your text.
And I just want to emphasize again, we proofread at the very end so that we don't waste any time. If we end up cutting something, we haven't spent any time looking a word up or finding a new word. and then ended up throwing that word away. So if we do this as a last step, the proofreading is going to be very efficient. So we're going to talk about some of the strategies that you can use to proofread now. The first strategy and the most useful, but for some people the most difficult, is to make sure that you have enough time to put the draft away for a few hours or ideally a few days before you go back and look at it again. It's very hard to proofread something that you've just finished reading. Primarily, it's hard to proofread something that you've just finished writing because when you go to look at it again, you're going to read what you think you said. If you're too familiar with it, you end up reading what you think you said rather than reading what you've actually typed on the page. By clearing your head and giving yourself some time, by putting the draft away for a while and finding a quiet place to proofread, you'll be able to look to see what's actually on the page. You won't be distracted and overlooking mistakes because you're not concentrating.
And just like with editing, you want to proofread an article or a chapter several times. So each time, make use of a different technique for proofreading so that you will be able to catch all of your errors. So proofread for only one kind of error at a time. If you try to identify too many things at once, you risk losing focus and your proofreading will be much less effective.
We also want to emphasize the fast writing, for many people, fast writing is difficult because they think, what if I make a mistake? What if I make a mistake? Because we have all these serial processes, we've gone through the editing and we're going through the proofreading one step at a time and recording how we've done that. This will let you relax more in your fast writing. You can say, oh, it's okay if I make a mistake now, I'll find it later. So for the basis of effective proofreading, we encourage that you develop a style sheet of your most common errors. And what we mean by a style sheet is a list, an alphabetical list of things that you know you do, errors that you know you make, and so that before you send the piece out, you've gone through that list from the very top of the list, from the very bottom of the list, checking to see if there are any of those particular errors in there. So, for example, if you know that you often confuse affect for effect, affect with an A for effect with an E, you might put that on your style sheet. And then after you've done your editing, when you go to proofreading, you're going to check every occurrence of affect or every occurrence of effect by using things that find and replace other things. You're going to check every single occurrence of that to see if there's an error there and then fix that error. Once you've checked all the affects and effects, you check that off your style sheet and move on.
There are two proofreading techniques that are available for catching errors: computer-aided proofreading and hard copy proofreading. And you want to be sure to apply techniques from both of these categories as you're doing your proofing. So after you do computer-aided techniques, then you should always proofread a hard copy of your chapter or your article because, of course, it's very easy to miss errors when you're reading on a computer screen.
The computer-aided proofreading makes use of all the tools that you have available on your computer. So I just mentioned one of those with find and replace, right? You also have spell checker. You have a grammar checker. What you're going to do is you're going to, before printing out your hard copy of your text, you're going to go through and you're going to run your spell checker. You're going to run your grammar checker. You're going to use find and replace for things on your style sheet. But make sure that you also do a hard copy, because things like the spell checker, as useful they are, they're far from being foolproof. Spell checkers have limited dictionaries. They might not know a word. They might mark it as wrong. They also won't spell. They won't catch any misspelling. That's really because you used a different word. So, for example, if you type T-O for two instead of T-O-O, the spell checker won't catch that because T-O is a correctly spelled word. But this is a good start. So for a start, make sure that you go through your entire draft using your spell checker.
And, of course, grammar checkers can be even more problematic than spell checkers. These programs work with a limited number of rules. They can't identify every error, and they often make mistakes. And often, too, they don't really give you a good explanation to help you understand why. they're suggesting that a sentence should be revised. So you might want to use your grammar checker just to help you identify potential grammar problems, but you need to be able to evaluate the feedback that it gives you. So we really think that something much more useful than the grammar checker is that find and replace option on your computer that William talked about. And this is a good one to use to catch the errors that you've got on your personal style sheet. So again, like if you confuse its and its, I-T-S and I-T apostrophe S, then you can use your find and replace option for that. So we like that find and replace option. We don't find the grammar checker all that helpful, but it might not be a bad thing to run it and see what it tells you.
Notice that the style sheet's also going to give you a list of things to go through. So you say, oh, okay, I've checked all the things that I know I've made errors of in the past, and that it's a good thing that will let you, if you have 10 minutes to do some work, and you don't know what else to do, and you're at the proofreading, that's a good place to pick that up. When you've finished using the computer-aided tools, it's time to turn to the hard copy proofreading. In that case, you're going to print out your draft and read it through slowly. We recommend reading it out loud, which forces you to say each word and also lets you hear the words sound together. When you read silently or too quickly, you can skip over errors, even skip over a missing word, and make unconscious corrections in your mind so that you don't see them. So another technique that you could use while reading it is to point with your finger to each word that you read as you read one word at a time. Obviously, this is going to slow you down a lot, but that's the idea here. You want to slow down enough to catch errors.
You also might try separating the text into individual sentences. This is another technique that can help you read each sentence carefully. When you're working with a printed copy, use something like a ruler or a piece of paper to isolate the line that you're working on. Or you could also use two highlighters of different colors and alternately mark your sentences. This will help you identify beginning and ending punctuation marks and will allow you to isolate and evaluate each sentence. Another proofreading option is to circle every punctuation mark and every citation or footnote. And what this does is it forces you to look at each one so you can instantly see if one is missing. And as you circle the items, of course, ask yourself if the punctuation or the form of that citation is correct.
One of the things that might strike you at this point is that we think of proofreading a little bit differently than other people think of it. We think of it as a learning process that while you're doing it, you're investing time into the future, into your future writing as well. So we think you're not just looking for errors that you recognize, but you're also learning to recognize and correct new errors. This is where we think handbooks and dictionaries can be very helpful. If you keep reference books on hand, you can use them as you proofread so that you can check on rules that you're not sure of. If you're not sure about a semicolon use or a comma use, you can look them up and check them. When you've looked up a rule and you fully understand how to spell or punctuate something, make sure that you write the new rule down on your style sheet so that you can quickly refer to it in the future.
And don't stop to fix your errors on the computer at the moment that you identify them when you're proofreading. When you identify an error, just mark it on your hard copy and keep looking for more errors. If you've got a question about something, like write it in the margin or on a post-it note and put it next to the item in question. And then if you need to use a reference book to look up one error, then you can look up several at the same time. So marking your errors like this allows you to find answers to all of your questions at once, and so you don't have to keep interrupting your proofreading multiple times throughout the document.
Writing and revising an article or a chapter can look overwhelming in the beginning. You can find yourself looking at a blank computer screen or a piece of paper wondering how you're going to communicate your ideas effectively. We suggest that you relax and try some of these ideas that we've talked about for fast writing and slow editing. We suspect that you'll be delighted with how quickly you can actually begin to develop effective writing and editing skills.
Okay, at this point, we want to change directions a little bit and address another problem that sometimes surfaces in the writing process. And what we want to talk about is how to keep yourself writing regularly. But I'm kind of aware of our time here. Do we have time, Kim, to go a little bit farther?
Sure, that's fine with me.
Okay, and I guess if people have to get off, you know, they can when they need to.
Yeah, well, we can certainly go longer. That is
okay.
No problem.
Okay.
And anyone who isn't able to stay on any longer can always come back and listen to the recording later on.
Oh, that's right.
And
yes.
If they have any questions that that they can't get answered today, they can always email them, right?
Yes. Okay, great.
Right.
Okay, so what we want to turn to now then is something else that's involved in this whole writing process, and that is how to keep yourself writing regularly. And we're going to suggest one primary way to do this, and that is to enact the role of the scholar. So this means actually doing the things that make you a scholar. And so you might be saying, well, what's involved in enacting the role of a scholar? Well, being a scholar involves two major kinds of work. First one is coming up with ideas. The second is sharing them with others. So many people have excellent ideas, but until they document those ideas so that they can be scrutinized and tested by others, those ideas don't become part of the conversation of a discipline. So if you want to adopt the scholar role, you have to come up with ideas, and you have to make them permanent by writing them down. But what many scholars do instead is that they enact incomplete scholar roles. So you enact the first part of the scholar role, you generate ideas, but you don't complete the role by writing those ideas down so that they can be shared. So you've assumed a role that makes you into something other than a scholar. And so we want to point quickly to a few of the most common of these incomplete scholar roles.
So see if this sounds familiar to you. You sit down to write and you decide that, I'd better clean the kitchen cupboards, or I really should do the laundry, or, oh, look at that stack of newspapers. Maybe I'll just tie them up for recycling and take care of that now. Or maybe you think that you need to take care of your email before you can actually write effectively. Mostly you think if you could just get your inbox completely cleared out, you'd feel psychologically free and ready to write. With all of these dodges, you've engaged in performing a housekeeper role. What's going on here is that you believe that the conditions in your environment have to be perfect before you can write. So you spend your time making those conditions perfect instead of spending your time writing. Not surprisingly, your writing always gets pushed to the back burner then, because you're always there's always something else to do to improve your working conditions. The problem here is that instead of making yourself into a scholar, these activities are making you into a housekeeper. The motivation for engaging in these in the role of the housekeeper is obvious, though. If you're not sure how to begin on your writing, or if you're having difficulty getting going, or if you're feeling stuck or frustrated, cleaning up your environment is something that you can do that you feel control over, and so it makes you feel helpful and valuable. What you're doing is you're replacing a feeling of helplessness with a feeling of competence. Unfortunately, the feeling of competence doesn't bring you any closer to getting your writing project done. So a reason that people stay in the housekeeper role is that you are rewarded by getting a feeling of confidence when you're feeling helpless, and also you're rewarded by having some completed projects, clean cupboards or a finished recycling. At the time when you really need to be cleaning up the mess of the writing that's in front of you.
Okay, so let's try on another incomplete scholar role, and maybe some of you will recognize yourself in this one, and it's the model employee. And when you adopt the role of the model employee, you spend a lot of time doing an exemplary job in some area of your life other than your writing. And you think that this other area of your life is so important that it can't be compromised in any way, and so your writing always takes a back seat to it. Graduate students and professors often adopt the role of the model employee in their teaching. They spend a lot of time over-teaching, preparing way too much for each class. And you know you've adopted this role when you create complex, time-consuming methods for grading, when every lecture is a glitzy media presentation, when you radically redesign every class each time you teach it. And, of course, you can also be a model employee in your personal life. You can choose to be the perfect spouse or partner or parent, for example. And what's happening with the model employee role is that although you know your priority is to do your writing, you keep busy with less important short-term tasks. And, of course, once you're immersed in the busyness of this other area of your life, there seems to be no room for any other high-priority task. And, of course, let's not forget how much support you get for enacting the role of the model employee. Your boss or your spouse or your partner tells you you're doing an exemplary job in this area of your life. And at a time when rewards are hard to come by, those kinds of rewards are precious. It takes a long time to feel competent as a writer. But as a model employee, you're already demonstrating your skills and your competence.
These are just two of the incomplete scholar roles that we encounter in scholars all the time. We describe a number of other ones in our book, and those include the patient, the good student, the proxy critic, the undocumented worker, the maverick, and the executor. You might want to check out these if you think that you might be an incomplete scholar in one of these ways. It might help you find a way out of that.
But, of course, the most important thing is not to figure out what role you've adopted, but how to get out of that role. So what if you've recognized yourself in one of these incomplete scholar roles? How do you switch from being an incomplete scholar to a scholar? Well, the way out is actually very simple, and it's to write regularly. Writing regularly is what will help you confront those incomplete scholar roles head on, and it's what will transform you from the housekeeper or the model employee into a scholar. Because what most of the incomplete scholar roles have in common is that they allow you to do things other than write. And so to counter them, you want to make writing a regular, recurrent activity. So we want to just suggest a few strategies for making writing a regular activity for you.
The first one we want to suggest is that you should write on a schedule, that you should consider your writing the same way that you would consider teaching a class or going to a job. Even if you just have an hour or two to devote to writing each week, make sure that you schedule it. You wouldn't, if you schedule a class, you wouldn't not go to the class, right? So we suggest that you schedule your writing time and that you make writing during that period a sacred part of your day.
And sometimes reconceptualizing how your writing fits into your day can help you develop and keep a regular writing schedule. Many people conceptualize their research and their writing as something to fit in around their teaching. See if you can reverse that thinking. Your writing is now your real job. Conceptualize everything else as something that gets in the way of it and that disrupts your writing time. So let's say you're writing away and it's time for you to go and teach a class. Our guess is that you are likely to have said in the past something like, oh, good, I can stop writing because it's now time for me to go teach. But when you conceptualize your writing as your job, your new attitude becomes, oh, is it time for class already? Too bad, because I was really making good progress on this project. So try to flip in your head what you see as your primary responsibility and make it your writing.
When you consider your writing your primary responsibility and you've scheduled it, take into account the time of the day that you're best. If you're a morning person, then schedule your writing time in the morning. If you're an afternoon person or an evening person, schedule your writing time for that time. Whenever you schedule your writing time, move the things that tend to eat up your writing time, things like preparing for teaching or grading papers or paying bills, doing laundry or reading email, whatever those other things are, schedule those for times when you're a little bit more tired. Save the time that you work best, whether it's in the morning or in the evening, save the time that you feel most energized for your writing time.
Now, maybe you're somebody who has trouble keeping yourself on a schedule. Well, here's something that could help. Keep a record of how many hours you write every day, and then share that number with someone at the end of every week, maybe your spouse or partner or a colleague. And record keeping makes you aware of how much time you're actually writing. And equally important, being accountable to someone else makes a big difference. Without a commitment to share your records with someone else, you can easily convince yourself that you're going to begin writing tomorrow. And, of course, that then doesn't happen.
Another strategy that we really like is there's these little post-it notes that you can buy for bookmarks, the little different colored pieces of paper, kind of see-through. What we like to do is use them to visually track the number of hours that you need to work. So, for example, let's say that you want to work 15 hours a week. You have a project, you know you need to do that 15 hours a week and stay on that schedule to get it done. Well, what we say is that you get 15 of those brightly colored little post-it marks, the bookmarks, and you put them on a wall or a file cabinet where you're writing. And then for every hour that you write, you go ahead and take off one of those post-it bookmarks, and you see exactly where you are in the process. This gives you a feeling of accomplishment, also tells you where you're going. We saw this work very, very well for a faculty member at Georgetown who was so committed to getting her hours. She put those on her file cabinet, and she kept track of that. In particular, what happened was that if she got to the end of the week and that she didn't have her hours in, what she would do is she would hire a babysitter, and then she would bring the babysitter in, and instead of going out to the movies or instead of taking the night off, she would go in and finish off whatever number of hours she had left to get through that week.
Another critical piece of writing regularly is to know when to stop. When you're done with your scheduled writing period for the day, stop. Put your writing aside. It's okay. You've met your goals for that day. There's no reason to feel guilty. You might be tempted to keep going if you're making good progress on your writing project, but learning to stop at regular times for breaks, for food, to do other things, is a very important part of learning to write regularly.
We have no doubt that things are going to happen, that you'll come across obstacles, that you'll get stuck, that you'll get confused at different points. But we believe that if your tendency is to stop writing at those points and do something else, the project will get out of hand and a large amount of time can get by before you've finished. We think that one of the number one things to address incomplete scholar roles is writing regularly. This came clear when one of Sonia's students, who was writing his dissertation and took a much longer time than was expected to finish his dissertation, when he said, "Hey, I could have done this much, much sooner if I just sat down and done it." So we think that, yes, sitting down on a regular schedule is something that will make your writing happen. We hope that if you follow even just a few of the tips that we've shared with you, that your writing will truly be enjoyable and that it'll be more efficient. At this point, we'll take any questions that you have.
This is Jeff Belliston. I'm curious, how important is it to print out your draft between the passes of the slow editing process?
We addressed that a little bit earlier before. If the drafts get very noisy, very messy, then it's important to print out a new draft and move from there. But if you've let's say that you've cut out a paragraph with a big X, you can go through that draft again and go to the next level of editing. Sometimes people do it by just numbering paragraphs, right? You might move paragraphs around by making new numbers. What I would say is it's only important if the markings that you've made on the hard copy get too difficult to follow.
I guess my question is actually probably higher up than that.
Oh, okay.
You must do it on a hard copy.
Oh, well,
Yes, I think so. I think that you react very differently to text on a computer screen than you act to text on a hard copy.
But also we're older and younger people might be more used to that. So I guess I would say if it works for you, use it. Does it
Thanks.
Work for you?
Can you give me an example of kind of a work week in terms of a writing work week? How many hours is like enough and how much is too much, you know, on a regular week, not when you have deadlines or something like that?
The first answer we would say is that writing regularly means really regularly, that you're not having a different writing schedule for a deadline than you're having normally. And a lot of this is, there's a fellow named Boyce who talks about this, that if you can write 3 hours a week on 3 different days, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, that's probably the minimum, but a very efficient and effective writing schedule. And then from there, moving up from there, you know, 3 to 5 hours is a good amount of time. And remember, we're talking about just writing now in the writing time, not doing any of the reading, not doing any of the collecting of the data or anything else.
Right. I understand. Thank you.
And also, William and I think, have a little bit different view on this. I mean, William's really good at helping people who haven't been writing get going by just doing a little bit so that they feel successful, and then they you know, keep at it. I love to write. It's the thing I do most. I really do conceptualize my job as writing. And there are 3 days during the week, regular week, when I don't teach. And usually, if I can, I will spend all day of those days writing. But for some people, that would just seem like horrible. So
yeah.
So don't follow that if that seems like something you can't do. You know, take it small at first so that you feel successful and so that things really do happen in that writing period.
Okay. It's much more important to avoid binge writing, because if you can just write regularly, the time that you're not writing becomes very efficient. It becomes a time for thinking about your project, keeping the project going. You come back to sit down, the project's still alive in your head. If you binge write, there's tendency is to sit down, write until you get completely exhausted, completely frustrated. And then it's very, very difficult to get back to writing because the feeling that you left the writing with is one of frustration and exhaustion. And so you just don't want to turn around and go back to writing. Binge writing tends to make people stay away from writing.
I have another question to ask related to starting the writing process. Again, I'm from perhaps a older generation and used to prefer writing things down in longhand before I even put it on the computer. And now with the computer, I try to construct and develop, you know, on the computer, but that's not really my style. So could you say a few words about that?
Yeah, I used to do that too. And I started writing on a typewriter. So I would write longhand and then type. But now, that's just if I were to do that, that's a complete waste of time. You know,
so you'd rather go on and start on
exactly,
the computer.
Exactly. And sometimes sometimes I will move from my computer to a piece of paper just to kind of jot down, like, what is it I'm trying to say here? You know, get my key ideas just really, really rough on a piece of paper, and then I'll go back to the computer. And I think, certainly I think there are two different kind of things going on in your brain when you do that. But if you persist in that, it's just going to slow you down. So
okay.
I would say work.
Sounds good. Good advice.
Yeah, work at doing it on the computer. We've got great technology now, so use it.
Okay.
Other questions?
Nope.
Hi, thank you so much for this wonderful teleconference. The whole thing about the writing versus other things related to your writing, like the data analysis or making tables and making figures, I've been struggling with that notion of, do I count my hour? Is it the pure writing, or is it, can I count when I made the table for the paper?
I usually say no when I'm working with my writers. And so if someone's having trouble with that, one of the things that I usually ask them to do is tell me about the process. If they're producing an article, for example, that's going to have a table or that's going to review some statistics or something, you know, what needs to be done to get to the point where you're writing? And then we schedule those times so that you know, okay, well, I put in this amount of time. I put in this amount of time making the table. Now I'm going to move on to this other thing. The reason I do that is that people tend to really like making those tables,
mm-hmm.
And will spend 26 hours changing fonts. You know, I mean, I'm not saying that this is you. In the past, some of the things I've dealt with is that people will really spend much more time than they actually need to on the table,
mm-hmm.
or spend time making smaller adjustments that don't have a good cost-to-benefit ratio, the amount of time that went into the table to make a small change, okay, it's a better change, but it's not worth 2 hours worth of change. And if they really like that, it tends to really eat away at the writing time, something that they don't like doing, and so then they've made these great tables but have no text to go around it. So
I guess for me, the thing would be in answering that question, is making that table something that's really propelling me forward, or is it a distraction? Is it keeping me from doing something I don't want to do but I really should be doing? If that's the case, then I would say put that table aside and get going on what's really needed at that moment. So for me, for example, I hate doing those tables. And so if I had to do a table, I would probably do it first because I hate it so much and I'm not good at it, and it would propel me forward. But if you're using it as a distraction to avoid doing something, then I would say make sure it's not part of your writing time. And also don't forget, if there are things like that that are really, really time-consuming, and if you got a little extra income, pay someone to do them. Use your time as efficiently as you've got, as you can.
Hi, this is Jennifer. I have a question about using this process if you're doing a paper and article that's joint authored.
Mm. So how you would work the actual writing or the editing?
Yeah, I mean, would you split it up into sections before you start? I'm thinking about doing the free writing, between two or more authors.
Yes, I mean, I co-author a lot, and actually William and I have co-authored too, and what we tend to do is split it up, sections, and then we each do the free writing. We get it in pretty good shape, not polished, and then we'll send it to the other one.
Okay.
And then that person will do the big idea process.
Yeah.
You know, like any idea missing? Should we take something out? You know, have we got our argument right here? And then once we get that figured out for both of the sections we're writing, then we will each polish, and then we'll switch again, and we'll each edit each other so that the style gets all combined. And so that the voice sounds the same.
So you've really done quite a bit of the editing by the time you start to share material?
No. Just the big ideas. Just the rough idea roughed out.
Okay.
Except that we also tend to do a lot of talking together before we write.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we'll really work out a lot of things ahead of time.
Okay.
But then we'll always hit those places where, like, oh, we thought we wanted to go this direction, but the person writing says, I can't fit this in, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll have those kind of conversations.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually do a lot of talking.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
One thing that I would want to emphasize there is that when co-editing, co-authoring, one of the big problems is time exchange. If you give someone, 20 or 30 pages and want them to respond to the whole thing on a number of different levels, it tends to go into a vacuum and disappear.
Yeah.
But if you've given them 20 pages that you say, okay, just blast through this really quickly, right? And just say, do you think we've missed anything? It's much easier for a co-author to come back and say, okay, well, it all looks good except for this one idea right here. So more frequent interchanges between someone for short amounts of time are probably going to be more efficient.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
This has been an educational presentation brought to you by the Text and Academic Authors Association.